interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special word from our sponsor.
Today I want to speak to you all about the charity of a media ecology. One only thing which is to all most evidently divine is manifested in the world. It is charity. The work of true religion should be to produce, to preserve, and to spread the spirit of charity. To arrive at this end, she must herself possess all the characteristics of charity in such a manner that one could define her satisfactorily in naming her organic charity. Now, what are the characteristics of charity? It is St. Paul who will tell us. Charity is patient, just like a macrobiotic cook. Patient like God, because it is eternal as He is. It suffers persecutions and never persecutes others. It is kindly and loving, calling to itself the little and not repulsing the great. It is without jealousy of whom and what. Should it be jealous? Has it not the better part of which shall not be taken away from it? It is neither quarrelsome nor intriguing. It is without pride, without ambition, without selfishness, without anger. It never thinks of evil and never triumphs by injustice, for all its joy is comprehended in truth. It endures everything without ever tolerating evil. It believes all. Its faith is simple, submissive, hierarchical, and universal. It sustains all and never imposes burdens which it is not itself the first to carry. Amen. I'd like a chicken salad sandwich. Hold the chicken, hold the mayonnaise, and hold the pickles. And I'd like an anthropomorphic casserole on the side. Thank you very much. I'll have a pizza, an extra large pizza with rennetless cheese and a double order of eternal ecstasy. Hold the anarchy. Thank you, Mr. Dogs.
discover the most trend-like wall changes and the motive forces thereof. That is to resolve itself into mechanics.
Human affairs are like a chess game. Only those who do not take it seriously can be called good players. Dobbs, we know that you haven't filled out your census. Your time has come, Dobbs. We're gonna phone up the census police, and we're gonna get you on your bike, Bob's, Dobbs, and we're gonna fine you $500. And then we're gonna get to hey, Bob's, and Dobbs. This is the census board, Dobbs, and we're gonna put marshmallows in your malted tofu milk, Dobbs, because we know that you like to do it the organic way, Dobbs. Well, all that's gonna stop, because we got the jellyfish on the shuttle, and we're gonna come back and we're gonna make jellyfish burgers, Dobbs, because George likes those little pork chips, Dobbs, and that's the way an all-American goes, you know, the carnivorous way, Dobbs, and we know you like tempeh, but you're not gonna get far with this, Dobbs. You better fill out that census form, and soon.
Hey, the headline in the Sun today says Tory mutiny. So there you go, Bob. Maybe your CBC prediction might come to fruition on time.
Bob, I need my therapy for tonight. So knock them dead. Send the pinks flying. Best to you.
Yes.
Hi, there's a cute article on Prescott Bush, who's George Bush's older brother, helping a Japanese company run by a major underworld group buy out an American financial firm on page A16 of the Star. Bye.
Hey, Bob, this is Sean calling. I guess you've seen Toronto Star's headline today about the group of 20. It's hilarious. Now, who can doubt you now, Bob? I mean, it's coming. And this group was apparently even started in December after you made your public declaration on CBC to Brian Mulroney. So there it is. I mean, even though Bob's not on the radio anymore, it's obviously taken to other forms of exerting his influence. So give me a call if you get a chance. I should be home tonight. All right, talk to you later. Bye.
Bob? I recently just left a message. My name is Chris. I caught your show late last month. Can you please, just briefly, defend your proposition that George Bush is a good guy and not a bad guy? From what I've heard of him and what I've seen, I'm not too impressed. So if you can briefly just go over that on your show, I'd much appreciate it and set the record straight. Thanks very much.
Fourth Bob has to be Connie.
Hi, Bob. It's Doug calling. It's around 5:45 on Friday. It's called It's time to check in again. A few things. First of all, the group of 22, Bob, who surfaced 2 days ago, wasn't on the 11th, was it? Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Wouldn't be 2 days ago if it was. A group of people encompassing all political persuasions, it seems, at least as far as the mainstream goes, and telling Canada what should be done. Bob, your hand is again guiding us. Something you may not have heard of, but I thought was interesting, June 23rd, which I guess is the Group 23 conspiracy. This June 23rd in the UK, the oldest Unitarian church, it's approximately, I think, about 350, 400 years, is having a day of silence in the cathedral. It's like you pledge for someone, and someone goes into their church, and for 12 hours, they're silent. Basically, it'll be a bunch of people sitting in a church, not saying anything. I guess this media ecology, again, put out by you and homeopathically ingested by others. And Bob, today's column by Brian Fawcett, again, what is it, like he's like 4 years behind you, and again, he didn't understand what McLuhan was talking about. I mean, he briefly sort of has a good cant on the intellectuals or the church of tenure, but, you know, he hasn't been listening to the show, Bob. Basically, that's his problem. And even if he did, it probably he wouldn't understand. Hope all's well. Hope you and Connie are maintaining your alert, your Dobbstown alert, and hope to hear from you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, Bob. This is Andrew. Just a few more thoughts on Twin Peaks. It reminded me somewhat at the end there of the movie The Exorcist. Cooper seemed to me to, of course, the actor, the role of the priest, gave a last rites to Leyland. And like the priest, he offered up his own soul. But did he lose his soul? Perhaps he hasn't. Like Leyland, he was possessed by Bob. But we saw Leyland later on in the Black Lodge, White Lodge, and he seemed to have his soul. Maybe he has lost his soul just this round. When the sheriff told him that Annie was in the hospital, I think perhaps she had actually died. He told him that just to protect him because he wasn't well. She was covered in blood. Of course, she is Cooper's other self. The symbolic knifing of Cooper would explain how she was covered in blood. Perhaps it wasn't. I mean, yeah, I think it was an emotional thing to offer up his soul, but I don't think we should assume that Cooper could lose his soul, or anyone could lose their soul. It's just not something that you can give up. It's something that anyone can take from you. So if it can't be taken from you, then you can't give it, even if you say that. Also, on the subject of Slack, I've found kind of inadvertently lately, and I don't know what you might think of this, but I find listening to opera music stops my internal dialogue most effectively. And so I'm doing another little experiment. I'm going to try to listen to opera music during all my waking hours for the next while. I'll let you in on how it's working, okay? Catch you, bye. Or in Jungian terms, perhaps Annie is Cooper's anima. Bob is the raw male energy, the killer of girls and women, the vanquisher. And Cooper's anima was killed, leaving Bob to inhabit Cooper. Perhaps Cooper killed it himself through trying to control his emotions.
More earthquakes, war is the whole bit.
Revelation City. But anyways, we've had that for a long time. Here's the big news. Man who doubled for Stalin dies at 93. A man who looked so much like Joseph Stalin that he was hired to sit in for the Soviet dictator at meetings and banquets has died in the southern city of blah, blah, blah. He was 93. Even though he was 20 years younger than Stalin, the man so closely resembled the dictator that when he joined the army, he was dismissed almost immediately, the newspaper said. Even his facial scars nearly matched the Soviet leader's pockmarks from a bout with smallpox. A week after Rashid, that's the guy's name, returned home from the army, a KGB official appeared in his small village in northern Caucasus and whisked him away. His relatives were told there was no basis for concern over his fate and that he would return, according to the report. After Stalin's death in 1953, he moved to some blah, blah, blah place and was given a one-room apartment. So there you go. Doubles. Doubles, doubles, doubles. And, what else did that? Oh, yeah, 1,400 troops being removed from Germany. I like that, eh? Brian Mulroney immediately has to confirm Bob's new number and go, okay, we'll resonate around that one.
Happy Bloomsday, Bob.
Bob, it's Doug. Something I forgot to mention the other night when we were talking, reading in the newspaper about Jean-Luc Godard, a little interview someone had with him, and he, again, he's at least a year behind you, Bob, as everyone. I mean, that seems about to be as close as anyone can get. But he said that the biggest criminals during the Gulf War were the anchormen, which I think goes back to your interview where you said that they were the biggest terrorists in the world, people like Peter Jennings et al. That's it, Bob. Just forgot to mention that. Thought you can put that in the archives. See you later.
The Dobbs are having a party tonight. A bill-burning party.
So, hi, Bob. It's Tim here.
How's Annie?
Boy, it certainly makes you wonder if there's supposed to be a third season or not. Anyway, any thoughts on that last show and what's happening with you? What's happening with Carolyn? Anything exciting going on? I'm at home, so might talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Strange because their parents are also brother and sister. There were four Taylor kids, Jack, Rhonda, and Jim, two Jims for some reason. We'd get up every morning and sort of hack around in the tobacco patch. And when it got too hot, we'd just sit around on the porch and sort of stare out. But the landscape around there was completely desolate, except for the tobacco plant. Standard Oil had strip mined it in '30s. And just when some vegetation was beginning to grow back, they discovered that a certain kind of low-grade shale could be converted to oil. So they came back in and drilled holes, very deep holes, hundreds of feet down into the bedrock. But they never got around to filling them in afterwards. They just sent down a shipment of manhole covers. But nobody ever bothered to put them over the hole.
A catalyst changes everything, but it remains unchanged. I've been called that. The Baroness Rothschild says that I'm the catalyst. So if you get one person on the planet to say that you are something, you've got something to work with. So if two of us say that, I'm a catalyst. I am looking for people to make Judgment Day a reality and to realize that neither God or anybody else is going to judge humanity. They have to do the judging as to what is proper for them to survive. Now, they can judge whether I'm really telling a lie or whether I'm telling the truth. If I'm telling a lie, they have to judge whether the lie is more profitable to them than the truth that they know. So therefore, I'm paving the way for humanity to recognize the myth and become part of my mythocracy instead of their theocracies and their democracies and the otheracies they got they can become part of the magic myth, the magic type of the mythocracy.
Okay, Wayne.
All right.
That was Sun Ra, last message.
That was Sun Ra.
That was Sun Ra, yeah.
No kidding. Yeah, he'll be back into town. Yeah.
When's he coming?
Sometime in August at the Apocalypse Club.
Okay, well, you notice he was using the phrase mythocracy, talking about his own Sun Ra myth. He's referring to the mythic government warfare phase. You remember that? You remember that? Comes after universal government, mm-hmm. mythic government, and mythic government lockdown,
right.
which happened from 1977 to 1990. So we're preoccupied with mythic government warfare now as a distracting figure, since the generals always fight the last war, while the hidden ground is locking down Bob Rule. Okay, Wayne.
So now we're practicing Bobocracy.
Yeah, the proper myth.
Right.
The politically correct myth is Bobocracy. It's a myth of the myth. You know, as a mirror and as an echo. Myth being a derivative of the Greek word mythos, which means word. Word makes the market. We've been through this before.
Uh-huh.
Now, the next 45 minutes, Wayne, is going to be very boring for maybe a lot of subgeniuses. So I recommend that they set their alarm clocks, go to sleep, set it for, say, 1 o'clock, 5 after 1, wake up, and then we can have our staff meeting and everybody can participate. For those subgeniuses who are interested in metaphysical issues, the next 45 minutes will be very interesting. This is going to be our last communication from the Axis. We might as well tell you now, this is the second last Bob show. Bob's moving out of Toronto. Last show will be August 8th, so tape this next 45 minutes if you want to get something that will be relevant to you in 30 years, 14 years at least. All right, Wayne, so this was recorded on April 26, 1991. We're going to let it run through. You'll hear stuff about chaos in quotes, chaos, the new physicist concept. Hear about fractals, but at the beginning, more general principles about order and nature, and for Sean, the geometry that we promised a month ago. And also, there's some technical information talked about. You won't be able to catch it all, but if you tape it, it's worth hearing later, and then you'll enjoy the Exus comment. So this is the last communication from the Exus in Toronto.
All right, I'd like to go to a more metaphysical level, or maybe it's science or physical, I don't know. My opening question would be, where does order come in nature, in the sense that the sun comes up the same day, the same way? Where is this basic order from?
This would seem to set aside itself from the chaos theory that everything is moving towards chaos, and that order precedes chaos. That order in the universe is found by the observer. You see, that you observe that the sun is rising on a certain pattern, setting on a certain pattern, that there is order from the observer's perspective. Is it the observer that see the order that is already there, or is the observer the cataloger of that order which is there, or is there, across a length of time, no order, but through a certain small window, it appears that there's order? Or is there a pattern to the universe? Now, order comes from existence. You must have existence in order to have order. If you would see that that which you see is order, but only because you are trained to see it as order. And So where does one go from there? Now, is there a design behind the universe?
Yes. Good question.
The answer is yes.
What are the elements of that design?
First cause. You can say that first cause is God. Not that everything precipitated from that first cause. It can be argued that this came from that and this came from that. But where did the original that come from?
Yeah.
Well, so therefore, first cause. Now, realizing that this universe itself is a fragment of a much denser universe. That once that denseness moved out of vibration into this vibration, it was literally as one would burst a balloon. A very dense portion that at that point of being transferred from one vibrational universe to another vibrational universe would explode it, as anything would do in comparative state. So therefore that denseness, Imagine the denseness. This entire universe would act within a small space. And from that became this universe. One universe bred another that was much less dense in this universe, much less dense.
And more being bred?
Could another vibration, yes. Would a universe be then created within this universe? No, because this universe there exists. It cannot happen in that way in this universe again.
Is that a dense beginning? That's the first cause, that dense situation?
But what caused the previous universe that was so dense? Ends wish to go back to that universe beginning, and you'll find another universe behind that, even more dense.
Well, is that what you mean in a previous reading on death, that that you have not found God, you have not seen or heard first cause?
No. We search, and search as one can. One can but search on the vibration level of where one is at this particular juncture of growth. If you would imagine, and it's very simplistic, but the little dolls that nest inside each other, that the innermost doll at one vibrational level created a different vibrational universe in which the second doll could exist, but they are no longer in connection with each other because they're now at different vibrational rates. And that doll, the second doll, could create a small fragment of itself in another vibration. And so it goes. The alternate density that we ourselves cannot reach is on a different vibration. Very different. The universe before this, very different. Very different.
So when I first asked that the original, that the EGs had not found the original density, you said yes, because I didn't hear what you said. You said yes.
They've not found it.
Yeah. Okay, so then where, then thought is part of reality. Thought tries to visualize what it looks like, the first cause. Never seems to succeed yet, but the spin-offs of thought are useful.
One postulates by inference that because of that which is observed, then it is inferred that that which caused it must be this, that, or the other. But the observer's position is the vibration in which the observer is. Let us suggest for a simple moment that all you could see is colored green.
The color green.
Yes. Everything is green.
Yeah.
Everything. Now, it's postulated by certain scientists that green light is comprised of two other vibrations, of which, for convenience sake, one is called blue and one is called yellow. But realize, you cannot see yellow in a green universe. Cannot. Everything is green. It's only postulated. But you see, the postulate is from where you are. You must realize that those who would postulate this would be not ridiculed, but no one could visualize it. They would say that the previous universe was a different type of green, a different type or color green, a darker green. Because green is the dominant. No matter what someone else would postulate, it must postulate from within that paradigm which you exist. History has shown this time and time again. When there was a lack of movement or minimal movement in the world, that a giraffe to be believed, no one believed it. There would be travelers that would return and say there were these animals that had these characteristics, and others would say utter nonsense. Nothing could exist such as that. Cannot. Well, if you take a look at a dinosaur, you would look at a dinosaur and you would say, because of that size, that bulk, and that massiveness, it must be a water-borne animal, because it could not support itself. Could not. It would have to eat continually, and it would have to continually walk on four paws. You see? Have to do this. But now, it has been realized that when the dinosaurs roamed, the oxygen content of the very air in the earth was considerably more than now. So, that makes sense. So possibly it's not waterborne. Possibly it was a land animal, just as its toes suggested it would be, and just as its vertebrae suggested it would be, etc., etc. You see? That is the greater problem with observation. People observe from where they are.
And part of observation is thought.
Yes.
And the evidence say everything comes from thought.
Everything.
And therefore, the new things we've made have come from thought. So even though thought is speculation, and has a lot of, you look back to the history of thought, it looks pretty limited. And it is still useful.
It is extremely useful because, you see, those that step outside of the paradigm, this is cultural and it's sociological, but many learn such things as it cannot be done. They learn that. that certain things cannot be done. The favorite example being used in these days is that the head of the patent office in the United States suggested closing it down in 1883 because everything that could be invented has been invented. Now, yes, it appears very humorous from this perspective, where there has been considerable change. But the time from 1883 to this year, 1991, 100 and some years, has taken those number of years to achieve that which exists in this world. And that has been existed by people who had thought that it could be done. Now, this is not a paying of praise to those that say it can be done in the face of those who say it cannot. However, examine for a moment thought. The thought within a paradigm that gives itself permission to increase its own paradigm. Very few allow themselves to do this.
Why is that? Why don't people allow that?
Because if you stay within the paradigm, you're sane. If you go without the paradigm, or beyond the paradigm, you're insane. Now that's just as the patent head of a sociological. You see, think of some of the quote crazy thoughts that would be seen from the perspective of 100 and some years ago. How long to a person in that age would it take before people would be able to move from one side of the country to the other in a space of hours, not days?
Mm-hmm.
Now, using all the means of prognostication, all the means of extrapolation, and carry it forward, carry it, logically mean that someone would be able to cross country in 12 hours in approximately 2400. Now, obviously, this does not mean that there is an acceleration of invention. What it means is there's an acceleration of those who would try to change the curve.
Yes.
There is a curve on computers that says by this, if all things hold true, this curve means that computers will be this way in the year 2000. Now, that's interesting, but there are many things, that's only the base curve. It does not allow for invention. Invention is that spark that ignites a totally different path.
It's like a human version of the first cause.
Yes. Yes.
Well, thought created, but thought then is what creates this order. The perspective of observance and the thoughts within that observance create the order that we call order.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me just...
Take this one step further. The Greeks believed, the ancient Greeks, believed in order above and beyond all. The philosophers argued for order. They argued... Because to the Greeks, very little changed across 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years, nothing changed. There would be some new buildings, but it would be the same technique. There would be new organizations formed, but they would be clones of other organizations. Even philosophers were not allowed to make change. The philosophy had to fit the philosophy yardstick. so that one would say that this would be preferable, he was told to kill himself, and kill himself he did. Realized that the amount of change was limited by legislation, it was limited by philosophy, it was limited, but could not a different element in this particular century.
What's the different element?
That it's more acceptable for invention.
I see.
And that has only been for the past 200 years.
All right, now let me take some particular concepts and see how they relate to what you said. The Hubble Space Telescope, some data consisted of images that came recently. Images of a small region in the Orion Nebula,
yes.
A large cloud of plasma, gas, and dust containing many young stars. These images revealed in greater detail than ever before the structure of a plasma jet, in quotes, emerging from a young star. Instances of this phenomenon have been observed only since 1981. The geometry is reminiscent of that seen in laboratory experiments with magnetic plasma pinches, and in particular the Beltrami vortex configuration seen in, quote, force-free plasma pinches.
Yes.
The similarity of this jet to the Beltrami vortex plasma pinch may support the recently developed model of Daniel Wells of the University of Miami for the formation of solar systems based on his theory of force-free plasmas. In the Wells approach, the apparent jet is actually a plasma pinch filament on which the star has emerged. The conventional jet concept works the other way around. The star has formed from gravitational collapse of formless gas and dust, and for unknown reasons emits a jet or a pair of bipolar jets for a time early in existence. Is the Wells approach more accurate?
No, the Wells approach is more accurate.
All right. Now, the helical geometry of a plasma pinch column, that is, a plasma through which an electric current is passing, right. This geometry, helical geometry of flow, is force-free since all of the fields of force are parallel to these helices.
Yes.
The fluid velocity field, the electric field, and the magnetic field have streamlines that follow these helices. If such fields of force are parallel, or rather more generally collinear, then their interaction is zero, and the configuration is termed force-free.
Yes.
So that's accurate.
Yes. Don't interact to force-free, but each one of those forces within that formation is independent to itself. When does that then collapse?
That's coming up to this next point I'm going to quote. I'll lead up to that by saying this Beltrami vortex geometry bears an essential resemblance to the helicoid, where the vortex column is taken as having an infinite radius. Now, that's just a reference point. Now, surfaces with a negative Gaussian curvature and a zero mean curvature are found to be minimal surfaces, and just as the least action paths for two-dimensional trajectories in physics are curves like the cycloid, the least action configurations for surfaces under tension, like soap bubble surfaces, are minimal surfaces.
Yes, must be.
Right, so that LaRouche has suggested that the Beltrami negative curvature approach to the physical geometry of space-time provides an important advance beyond that made by his close collaborator Bernard Riemann. The Beltrami did make advances beyond Riemann. Would you agree?
Yes.
All right. So then the work of Daniel Wells and Winston Bostick has shown this Beltrami approach is most fruitful for constructing a universal mathematical physics applicable over the particle, atomic, plasma, and astrophysical scales.
As an adjunct, too, you cannot throw out the baby with the bathwater.
And what is the baby that's being thrown out?
You cannot throw away the atomic gravitational. You would throw out gravitation, and you would throw out the curve of gravitation. It could be that certain curves of gravitation are also within themselves free. The parallel with certain gravitational forces are other forces upon the atomic level. No, it is an adjunct. But you cannot throw the theory out.
It's not that much of a paradigm shift.
No.
But it's a new good addition, or a useful addition.
Oh, most assuredly. The point is, when you have such a term like a spindle,
yeah,
would be a useful term. You have this spindle, and everything within itself is autonomous unto itself. Essentially, you have potential energy, but you have no action. The helix itself exists because, as pointed out, it takes minimal form. Wherever there is such a situation such as that, it will automatically take minimal form.
Yes.
But its forces being autonomous make them virtually as if they're not there. And since there is no interaction, there is no interchange, there is no shifting on certain other levels. Magnetic is magnetic, gravitational is gravitational, electrical is electrical, almost as though they're isolated forces. When and where and under what conditions does that then cease to be, and then when and under what conditions does it become another phenomenon?
All right. Further quoting, it is not the determination of stable equilibrium configurations that is most crucial in physical science, but rather the internal geometry of transfinite transformations.
Exactly.
That manifest increasing densities of singularities within any increment of action.
Absolutely.
This is most clear in the particular case of Beltrami plasma configurations. Is not the plasma stationary force-free geometry as such, but rather the dynamic transformation toward more highly ordered geometries more rich in singularities, in which the Beltrami approach comes into its own.
So therefore, order is made out of chaos, but it's in actuality, order is made out of another form of order.
Yeah, it only looks like chaos.
Exactly.
And that's the limitation of the popularity of the term chaos today?
Exactly. One would look at two, three, four ants, you would say chaos. But if you look at an ant hill, you would say order.
Yeah. The plasma pinch, for example, far from being a stationary system, is primarily characterized by, quote, pinching. That is, the plasma is undergoing self-compression to higher densities.
Yes.
Now, we began from a very dense first cause. Are we going where this universe is going denser?
The density of this universe is, in actuality, that which is not dense coalesces to a denseness and would appear as if the universe is becoming denser. But in actuality, only various portions are converting form.
I see. Implicitly, Beltrami
being defined.
And now, do you mean by defined visualized?
Not so much, because you can grasp it at any specific point. Like when you stop on the magnification, you can see what it is right there, right?
So you mean it can't be verbalized?
You can't predict what's going to happen next. Like it just keeps going, but each next step is different than what you might expect it to be. You really can't say what it's going to be like next.
So you mean by definition that leads to anticipation, and it can't do that?
Yeah, you can't anticipate it, so you stop trying to predict what's going to happen, and you start. It leads you more into questioning than looking for answers. When you're looking through them, you're not looking for an answer. You're more enjoying the process of examining them.
So it's percept.
Yeah, it's all percept. It really forces percepts onto you.
Which evokes questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, just this wonder process as you wander through it.
Yeah, it's just, it is a weird sort of reality, because you're just wandering through it with no purpose other than to wander through it.
Yeah.
Like I've had a lot of people, when I was trying to talk to them about it, they're going, well, what's it good for? And I don't know, what is it good for, right?
Tell them that it's a good metaphor for listening to the news over any period of time.
Yeah, it's more of it's like a mental exercise and training percepts as opposed to like trying to get answers to it. And you see it in all the writings on chaos and stuff. They can't really say what it's going to do. All they can do is just play around with it and see what happens. Right? And they in this fractant program, they've got them classified, but they've only got the basic form classified, and they can't really draw any connections between them. They're starting to break it down to categories. It's kind of funny. It's like one of those Peterson Field Guides to North American birds. They call it Peterson Field Guide to fractals, and they list everyone. They got the gingerbread fractal and all that stuff. It's really neat, though.
So it's either we're into a totally new zone that, as the exorcist said, it's going to take a long time to begin to get a language for it.
Yeah, well, what they were mentioning, and I've heard it mentioned before, is basically this is going to create a whole new mathematics, and it's going to rearrange our whole perception of science. I mean, it's going to shake up everything. And if you look at all the periodicals on it, it's getting into every single science around now, and they all have to deal with it. Like, at first they were saying, well, it doesn't have anything to do with mind, but they're all beginning to realize that it's hitting at the basic percepts, and so they have to re-examine all their science. Like, if you get into heart surgery or artificial intelligence, or there's that guy doing the ones on earthquakes where you get the piling up of criticality, and then it breaks down. And so it's affecting every science, and it's going to shake up the entire science community pretty soon. It should be really neat.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what LaRouche's people say about it, because all that stuff I was reading was from LaRouche's scientists, and
I haven't heard anything from them on it. They haven't really said anything yet.
Yeah, that's from their magazine, 21st Century Science and Technology. So the stuff I was reading, the experts are saying it's accurate, but it's still only a fragment. So if we span all the schools, we can get a pretty comprehensive view.
Yeah, the chaos science is going to be neat, because it's not set out to do anything yet. So there's a lot of slack there. You can get a lot of slack if you go into it now.
Yeah, you mean exploit it.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing.
Well, I think this thing I just broadcast would allow someone to get a handle on chaos, because it shows the temporariness of the chaos metaphor and gives a larger perspective. See, no one in the world has ever heard that point, as Michael says when he comes out of trance, the fact that all these negative curvatures are at right angles with each other. That this is a whole new thing.
Yeah.
That all these forms are at right angles with each other. That is something that's never been thought of. So if you're going to university, you can use that and get
I'm not going to university, but I'm looking at the chaos stuff. I'm going to get into that and have some fun with it for a while.
Right. Well, if you ever get near any academic zone, hijack that new idea and you get some grants.
I'm going to hijack everything.
I guess so. That's a subgenius's priority when locked down Bob Rule.
Yes. Yeah, that idea of all these curvatures being at right angles, I was reading, Scientific America is a bit behind when they print stuff, but they were talking about all the different forms of reality, like relative reality.
Yeah.
And they listed, they're coming at what, they can't figure out if there's either 7 or 11. It's a 7-11 situation. So it's somewhere in that number, and they're not sure which one works, and some of them work. And you can go as high as 15 or as high as you want, right? And they find out, it's really neat, because they figure out that some of them work some of the time, some of them work better in other situations. So depending on what you want to do, you pick how many versions of reality you want, sort of how many curvatures you want. So it's not necessarily a matter of, it really doesn't matter how many are there, it's just what you want to use them for. It's
I wonder where
your percept is, the way you're observing it, and for what purpose you're
observing. I wonder where the number icon comes in. We know about the 22, as you pointed out a month ago. 22 is old hat now, and we got the 14. I think the 14...
Yeah, maybe they'll focus in on 14. I didn't notice them focusing in on that. It was either 7 or 11 or 15.
Right, well, the 14, the 14 sticking us right in the face, the G7.
Yeah.
G is the seventh letter of the alphabet. So you got the 7-7. There's the 14 right in front of us.
And no one's noticing it.
Yeah. What?
And no one notices it either.
Yeah, it was called the Group of Seven. Then they changed it to G7, which is like an FBI or a CIA government category.
Did you hear about that? They were going to expand the McMichael collection. They wanted to, you know the McMichael collection up in Kleinberg? They wanted to open that up. That's the Group of Seven, right? The original. And they were going to expand it. And I think they ran into some flack about that. They didn't want that done. So, That's another group of seven there.
Yeah, it's just that it was a group of seven a few years ago. It was a group of five, and then it became a group of seven about 5 years ago. And they just a couple of years ago, when the 14 started to show up, made the group into a G. So you get G777.
Yep.
So that could be, since the lockdown of mythic government, which the G7 guys are retrieving, the lockdown mythic government process from 1977 to 1990, G7 could refer to the 1977 aspect of the beginning of that phase.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got Tom Rich here. We got other callers.
Okay, yeah. Let you go.
Is there anything else? That was just, you just wanted to appreciate what happened, right?
Yes, that's it.
Well, we did it for you, Sean.
I might call back if nothing's happening on the show.
Okay, well, we got Tom Rich here, and he's a biting to go, and
all right, then.
It could be good.
Okay.
Thanks, Sean.
See you later, Bob.
Bye. Okay, we got another caller? Yeah, you're on.
Hi, Bob. It's Scott.
Hey, you're back.
Yeah, I'm back.
Hey, listen, just a second here, Scott, just turn it down, but you're an interesting sub-genius. Just get the volume here. I guess I have to put up with the loud volume. All right, Scott, now you're back. You're the one who infiltrated the LaRouche group. Can you give us a briefing, since this is the second last show? We may never hear from you again.
Damn, it's the second last show. That's got me all tore up. But the LaRouche group, I mean, what can you say? Yeah, the physics. The physics is what counts, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the LaRouche people, dealing with them personally, they're brilliant. There's some brilliant, dedicated, really beautiful people. No question about it. I mean, I don't know if I'd want them president or God or anything like that. But that's a long way from the point. They have a visualization. They really do.
Yeah, I knew they revitalize visual space.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a necessary job, because visual space isn't just wandering around drunk now, you know, having summits and not really sure how to create a sense of purpose. So,
have you noticed Now magazine keeps, you know, smearing LaRouche?
Well, I wonder why.
Yeah, I wonder why. I mean, they're due for some smiting is what it is.
Write them a letter, Scott. Give them a summer. Offer to write an article of your infiltration and tell them what they don't expect to hear.
Yeah, and hey, tomorrow's the last... last day for applying for news director of CKLN.
I wish you were going to do
it. Put in your resumes.
Yes, Scott has always been the news director waiting in the wings. Yeah, so what else did you... Are you out of the LaRouche organization now?
Well, I'm out, but I'm sympathetic. I mean, deeply sympathetic. I mean, Dennis. You remember Dennis? New Jersey? You said you'd met him.
Oh, yeah. Dennis Speed.
Yeah, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant guy. I mean, all the guys down there are brilliant.
You didn't feel that really two or three months ago when I last talked to you. It took you a while to get into that attitude?
No, why is that? I mean, I understood they're different. They're difficult. They're iconoclastic. They rub you the wrong way. There's no question they rub you the wrong way.
At first.
Yeah.
So they're kind of subgenius that way, but they're pretty confident on staying with people who will stay with them, right?
Sure. And, you know, they do function as a cult. They really do. I mean, you know, they could... I mean, in certain aspects, there's people that understand why they need certain amount of efficiency from other people.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you take a look at it from the outside, it does follow certain classic patterns, you know.
But all successful enterprises are cult-like in that sense.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, people enthused.
Yeah, enthused. Tom, do you have a question to this LaRouche? Ex-LaRouche.
Scott, can you talk a little bit more about the organization if we ask you some questions?
Sure.
What is the feeling amongst the organization with regard to LaRouche's possibility of getting out of jail?
Well, you know, I left New York a couple months ago. There were some people that were nervous that there was a ripple in the organization of people that would feel just fine if he stayed there, you know, a complacency, like now we can begin to interpret him.
Yeah.
But, other than that, I think everyone's marked in a deep sense. I mean, here's just an enemy that was eliminated from the government's agenda, you know? So easily, you take a 70-year-old gentleman and you just toss him into the can. And I think a lot of people feel for that. And I think that, you know, it'll be remembered that people felt for that.
Yeah.
what's happened to the others who were railroaded into jail as LaRouche was? What happened to some of the others?
People have been set free.
A lot of them have been let out.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's sort of proscriptions on their behavior.
Did you meet Bob Premack?
I saw him. I don't think I met him.
As I understand, he was incarcerated for some while. Was he released?
I'm not clear. I'm not.
Okay.
Okay.
Anything else? You want to talk about anything else, Scott?
No, not really. I'm really impressed to be talking to Tom. This is the first time I've ever communicated or interchanged with Tom.
Yeah, this is the first time he's been in the station in 5 years, and he got stranded, so he came down.
No kidding. It's a pleasure, but I did want to clear the stage.
Well, what did you want to talk about? Just the fact that we're a media college you starting in a month?
Well, I mean, like I said, I tend to be an overtly sentimental kind of guy. Yeah, I'm going to miss you from the stage. There's no question about that. I spent Bloom's Day. I went to Innes College, and I saw Passages from Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, I went, like, what's that, a movie?
Yeah, a movie from 1962 with just various readings chosen by this woman who'd done it on the stage first, I think.
Who, Campbell's wife? Jean whatever, Jean somebody?
I'm not sure.
Did she, what visuals did they have? I always wanted to see that movie.
They had visuals of three or four or five people, or two people particularly, in argument, back and forth. They were all staged just like, you know.
Anthropomorphic.
Like, yeah, like Irish guys might interact at any particular time.
Right.
Just very, very wise choice of passages. I mean,
and it was it had theatrical content.
Yeah, it did.
Okay, you didn't leave that message about Bloomsday with me, did you?
No.
Okay, Scott, well, living's easy in the summer, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to work for LaRouche in the summer, right?
Sure.
Well, what are you going to do?
What am I going to do? Well, hell, I'm just going to keep doing homework.
Yeah, Tom says you're going to have to work for Kissinger, I guess, for a while. And keep doing homework.
If Bob goes off the air, well, you know, what I do in summer, particularly since I've encountered Bob, is just read a lot of Finnegan's Wake and take in the sun.
Well, that's the best way to spend the summer in Toronto.
Right.
It avoids all that swarming. Okay.
Take care.
Thanks, Scott. We got another one? You're on, caller.
I'm on?
Yeah.
Great Lamb of God. It's David.
Dave, would you say the Lamb of God?
Great Lamb of God. That came out of, that was an old memory there.
For you?
Yeah.
What's it referred to?
About 1982, it was a saying of mine.
Is it from the Bible?
No, it was just something somebody said, and I started repeating it. You know how you get one sound in your head and you just have to repeat it?
Yeah, Tom, what would you say what you said, Tom?
Yeah, it's from the Bible.
Oh, Tom says it's from the Bible.
Great Lamb of God.
Great Lamb of God.
Now, I was going to ask you.
Full of the great.
Lamb of God. So is that your biblical Sunday school background echoing in your head?
Subconsciously.
Yeah, subconsciously.
Subconsciously.
Your cultural mantra. And you've been so removed from a discarnate condition from its visual space source that you didn't recognize it was biblical. Right?
There you go. But yeah, I don't even think of it in those terms.
Okay.
I was raised, you know, post-Christian.
That's right.
Yeah.
You weren't raised at all. Can't be raised under electric conditions.
Oh, thanks. Okay. That's good to know, too.
Yeah, so what do you want to go into?
You were talking about, you gave your little final penultimate poem about who you are.
Yeah, wasn't that good?
That was very beautiful.
Thank you.
And it was very sense of loneliness and how we all have to die alone.
No, I got Connie. I'll never die alone. Connie and I are going to redo Bucky Fuller and his wife, you know, die within 24 hours.
Oh, yeah, and you're going to, like,
And we're going to do it without doing suicide. We're going to just, you know, be like Marcel Duchamp, you know, talk about dropping dead and then drop dead. Together. Hey, we'll outdo Marcel Duchamp.
Didn't Maharishi Yogi do that? Or?
No, he's still alive.
No. Another guy. Oh, Yogananda.
Yeah, the George Harrison's guru. The original one. Autobiography of a Yogi, you mean?
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah.
He ate some fruit that he'd eaten in his childhood. He was very happy, and then he called a conference to die.
And then he knew this fruit would kill him?
No. No, he just felt like everything was complete in his life.
So he called the conference, and what did he do?
He stood up and fell back down.
Nice.
Like, yeah. Put it together.
Hey, what's with this music, Wayne? Is that Wayne's editing undertow? Tell him to be a cognizant. I don't know if it goes.
Listen, I haven't listened to the show since the last time Mike did it, and it's really moved from like a festival to a staff meeting, I must say.
Yeah, you heard the promo where we talk about staff meeting.
Well, you mentioned that. I thought that was a good phrase to describe what it feels like now as opposed to the sort of, I don't know, it was just different.
Yeah, well, the reason it's different is that I asked Wayne to let me do a few more shows to put out some information. It's more of a bureaucratic process where we're just putting out long chunks of good stuff from the Exus since we won't have access to it much longer.
Right, so, and that was excellent Exus tonight.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Did you tape it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something to keep. You know, it costs $500 if you want to get it yourself.
Well, there you go.
You got it for free.
There you go.
So what do you want to get into?
Well, you were talking about in your penultimate poem about creativity.
Yeah, and the creative process, miming the stages of human cognition.
Miming the see, that's different than the cliche kind of creativity that you talk about, right?
No,
you used to say that creativity is a cliche activity.
Yeah, the stages of apprehension are cliche processes, like the way you use your eye, ear, and mouth. Those are the stages of apprehension, and the creative process mimes that. So that's, if you think of the creative process as archetypal, it mimes the cliché process of human cognition.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I meant. But I also meant cliché, creativity's cliché in the conventional meaning is that it's obsolete and therefore overused by everybody, and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But I was using creative in a new sense here, in a sense of archetypal originality or a powerful sense when I talked about being at the center of the creative process. That's what I meant by that is the example that David Lynch acts out the cliche level of creativity, produces Twin Peaks, and it just mirrors me at the center of the creative process. Me, particularly, it mirrors and echoes my my life.
So when I write a poem the sounds come out of me and they're mirrored and echoed inside you, reverberate inside your organism, is that electrically compatible?
Yeah, if you mean that it reverberates inside my organism as in the life I act out and the media I use and the daily impingements of sensation that I encounter over a period of time when you're writing the poet, that's what I mean. It's a literal diary of me. Your poetry is a diary of me.
Right.
Or a documentary, you know, like Truth or Dare, Madonna.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, she just said people film them as she's walking around.
Sort of like Edie Sedgwick used to do at the factory, right?
Yeah.
See, that was a beautiful breakthrough in a way.
Well,
because
it's Old Testament work compared to my stuff. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is that what I do is not necessarily echoed in my postural maneuverings. It's what I think and say.
Postural physically.
Yeah, not just gestural and postural activity. For example, Tom Rich here could testify there's 1,000 times he has done something, said something to me on the phone that echoed resonant very strong immediately with what I was doing,
right,
or that I had anticipated it or something. It's just, it's hard to express, but it's the kind of synchronicity that...
Well, here's one, because the Exus was talking about the giraffes and the...
Yeah, and the dinosaurs.
Yeah, and just like the incomprehensibility that they exist.
Yeah.
And I was hanging out with these three giraffes at the zoo, and I was just stunned by them. And I wrote a poem, and part of it goes like this. If sound strives for silence, the giraffe is the last long sounding tone before conclusion, our final act of impressing creation with surprising results. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, giraffe with 11-kilogram heart.
Nice. Now, that's another way of saying that the hand of man... No, I'll say it this way. That's another way of saying that man's reach must exceed his grasp.
Mm.
So the giraffe's neck is the last reach of the grasp, and the reach must exceed the grasp. Or what's a metaphor?
So, but he stretched to with his head.
Yeah, that's where the hand of man never set foot, or the head of man never set foot. That's what the electric space has done. It's put our head into a new space. But our whole body, but we in the Western world are so cranially oriented, we think of it as an area where the head of man had never set foot.
Right.
But it's tactile. It's the hand. But so, yeah, your poem, see, this is the thing.
Yeah.
You're writing, you're meditating on giraffes. They evoke a poem which 2 months ago you never thought would have happened.
Yeah.
And then you tune into Bob and he talks about giraffes.
Right.
And then that reading was done on April 26th before you had the giraffe experience. So you see how the subgeniuses resonate in their private
life. I probably wrote it that week, actually.
April 26th?
I think so.
That's when you saw the giraffe.
That's when I made the trip to the zoo, yeah.
Okay, do you see how your life resonates as all subgeniuses with me?
Yeah.
See, so what I'm doing is like a macro matrix that all levels of political, linguistic, sacramental, and personal subgenius lives are like reflecting as fragments of it. Not in a belittled sense, but fragments. You know what I mean?
I think that it comes back to that you express the gap.
Yeah, and the gap contains everything.
Yeah.
So a lot of everything is going to, if it was documented, be reflected from me or echo me.
Yeah, I guess. I'll have to listen to the archives.
Yeah, this is meant to be redone, re-listened to.
Good.
Because I'm in a kind of trance here.
Now, just let me ask Tom Rich if he's...
Okay.
Have you killed Touché yet? Is he... Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't think I really understand what you're talking about, but I do know that Touché has been... working very hard trying to remove Bob off of CKLM.
Yeah, and it really was an unpleasant quality to the show, you know. And I'm just wondering if he was dead yet.
I'm not familiar.
You have no comment.
I don't know if he's dead or not. I think that he is a very despicable individual, and I think that. If we could get our hands on him, we would very much like to cut his strings.
Bob?
Yes.
Go ahead.
What do you mean?
Go ahead and cut his strings. I mean...
I wouldn't do that to my former butler. The thing is, he's miming the gap. He's reflecting something that has to be acted out right now.
Well, the shadow thing?
Yeah.
Why?
It's just because we're coming to the end of the final term. We've gone around the final turn a little while ago. Now we're coming to the end. For example, I predicted on CBC that Mulroney will be out in September. Well, Glenn Keeley's going to help cement that, and I pulled a few strings so that the courts would recognize his charges. And today, Glenn Keeley had the subgenius pleasure of being discarded as content all over Canada. And
he's pretty happy about it, too.
Yeah, and he's going to knock Mulroney out. This is all part of the process. He'll be gone by September. And then what's his name? Who are we talking about?
Touché.
Yeah, Tom Touché.
That devil.
He'll be gone by September. When Mulroney goes. So basically, Tom Touché mimes the last resistance by the mythic government lockdown phase, resisting the Bob lockdown phase.
What was he doing spying on you and Connie back in 69 with the hard on in the cabin?
Well, he was my butler.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you know, he was around. He knows a lot about me. You had to listen to the tapes to catch that.
Well, yeah, but that was a hilarious moment. I mean, the first Touché call was priceless, but it got really tedious.
Well, he identified himself as a very intimate knowledge of me, and therefore he used
right.
the biographical examples.
Right.
And everything he said there is true.
He's definitely trying to pull a lot of strings with Ryerson and Touché, and he's been working hard, and Bob's been in a karate-like style, trying to use Touché's weight against Touché.
Just trying that judo.
Yes.
Is he spearheading the thing to make CKLM kind of a pink? School schedules and all that.
He's right behind it in the wings, disguised.
And the best jiu-jitsu move we can make is on August 8th, note the 8-8, very important numbers, on August 8th will be our last show, and then we anticipate the media fast of 1992. Don't be there. And we're gonna be out of here before the September collapse of Mulroney and Tom Touché.
Are you going back to Dallas, or?
I can't say where I'm going, but I won't be too available here in Toronto for a while.
One last question.
But you get the point here. As Touché grabs for power to become ruler of the Secret Council of Ten, he finds when he gets there that it's not there anymore. And the ecology has been implemented.
The action's moved elsewhere.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well,
so those are just vacant seats.
That's right.
Yeah, that's good.
Vacant.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you about the crop circles. An aspect of it I wasn't aware of is that they all seem to turn up near stone monuments?
No.
Not so?
That's just in England.
Apparently the ones that have appeared in other places are also near stone monuments of different kinds.
There's another, I wouldn't go for that pattern. There's okay. another pattern why they are appearing where they are. It's very interesting, and I can't release that information yet.
Right.
But there is a pattern. Look for it.
All right. I will do that. Next show, would you like me to do an I-Ching reading during the show? And you can itch the public. You can. I'll call you up, and you can fast-forward the information into Sense.
Yeah, okay. You mean on August 8th you're going to predict the
future? I'll throw the coins during the show, and I'll call you up and tell you what I asked and what it said.
Oh, about what will it be about?
Well, about...
you know, what's your question?
Your agenda, your next step.
Okay, good, good. That's
okay.
A good idea.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, hello, Bob.
Oh, Edward.
It's been a while. I think there was a war in the Persian Gulf or something since I last talked to you. Or?
Yeah, it was the hologram war.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You notice they went after human scale. They always take a person. It's a personal war, right? It's a personal vengeance between Bush and Hussein. So what did we used to say, Tom? Must we continue
to mow down the Husseins
in order to show
that the
mixed corporate media's closing ranks
has nothing to say to
human scale. So mixed corporate media is pissed off at the revival of the human scale zone, and the figure for the human scale are people like Noriega and Hussein. These are mixed corporate media holograms personalized on the human scale level, so that's what the war was about, right?
Well, that Hussein seemed like a guy of small stature, kind of, whereas...
No, it's just that you don't declare wars on individuals who run countries. You usually declare wars on nations, you know, on groups. The idea that you're going to blow up the country to get one guy and you apologize to the citizens and try to avoid bombing them and bomb that guy's facilities as if it's all his, and the war appears not to be successful when you fail to grab him and put him in jail, that's a new dimension of warfare.
Yeah.
That's anthropomorphic. I think that's the mixed corporate media reacting against the new retrieval of the anthropomorphic scale.
Okay, it's anthropomorphic, and yet the constant complaint, we haven't seen any Iraqi bodies yet. And it's hard to actually see that many representations of them in the media.
Right, because the mixed corporate media aren't interested in those caught in the crossfire. They're interested in Hussein. They're going to go after him again. They're going to force his assassination by setting up this fake now where they're going to say that he has a nuclear bomb or something, a nuclear factory hidden away, and that'll force his co-generals to off him. This is the next phase.
The other thing that comes to mind, an echo of your previous format with...
Mike?
With Mike, a significant Exist reading you had back then in the 90 was something about the Exist voice saying that, it sounded actually utopian, I hate to say that word, but a thing about accepting individuals as individuals. And he said something like, that person there is good for a particular job. And it doesn't matter what that particular person is by category, you know, old, young, ethnic, religious, national difference. And I find that a personal touchstone because, as you know, I've kind of gone back to the blue-collar world a lot for the last few months. And there's a kind of tired... ethnocentric conflict out there, particularly directed at people from Africa.
Yeah.
You know, and if you've sort of insulated from it for a while, you know, it's kind of disturbing.
Well, that's mythic government warfare. Myth is crowd. And so the as the mythic corporate technological media fight it out or pretend to fight it out, also this reflected in crowd behavior on the anthropomorphic phase. So we're talking about another few years of tribal warfare, images of tribal warfare as the last gasp of mythic government warfare, and then we'll move into the late 90s and early 21st century as the age of the individual, which will be what the Exodus talked about, realizing that the human being as an individual is the greatest resource, and that will be the implementation of the global village situation for cultures interrelating to each other, is that the individual...
Toronto then?
Correct. Croatian tourists.
Yeah.
Tourists?
Tourists.
No, no. Oh, well, for a while, but then pretty soon you'll meet a Croatian, and you won't treat him as a Croatian, and he won't treat you as whatever you are. Mm-hmm. It'll be an individual recognition of the own person's capacities.
Mm-hmm.
See, it'll be a kind of huge anonymity, but every individual will be gravitating toward what it can do.
Is this part of a paradigm shift that's another manifestation is the fractal of information you were going into earlier, like a new kind of mathematical body of knowledge?
The mathematical area is a specialized field, and that's a necessary development of that genre with the interaction with the new technology. What we're talking about, the age of the individual, is the effect of the discarnate angel, the discarnate super angel. Each individual will wear so many technologies that he or she himself is a tribe, therefore won't be able to be limited by tribal definitions.
So, you've called that angelic autonomy before?
Super angelic autonomy.
Super-angelic.
So the electric autonomy will, right now, it's a position caught in the gap where it's waiting for a new world to be born while the old world refuses to die. Well, the mythic of warfare is the old world, and the new world is that point by the time 2020 rolls around and Bob Rule lockdown has happened and we've got fusion energy, the individual will be able to move all over the place, and it'll be still a world of wars and problems, but individuals will be recognized as containing the whole universe. I think Tom wants to say something. You're not indicating?
No.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's good. I think about what the exes said there all the time. That's a very good paradigm they laid out. It's basically, they said it was the recognition of the universalness of humans, you know? Universal man.
Yeah, I guess it's just that kind of inspiring thing we listen to religious radio programs for, like, the world tomorrow. I mean, you notice...
Yeah. Well, the thing is that all the original cultural optimism that came out of everybody's cultures and religions and philosophies of the past is being actualized technologically. The body of Christ, if you want to get Christian about it, has been manifested, and that means the second coming of every individual on the planet. So it's a mystical process made actual and concrete. Therefore, the Gnostic religion will be have a last gasp of flashy interest, but then fade away when everybody realizes that the cliché is the most advanced state to be in. Yourself. Be what you are, which will not be visualized. What you are will not... You'll be wearing all the whole world and all this technological content. You'll be wearing all that, so you won't be able to be classified in any kind of anthropomorphic way. Yes, Tom. Oh, I thought you were pointing out something. So you get that?
Well, Tom should say something. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say that these points that you're bringing up are points which, since Bob at the beginning of the show was talking about himself, I think we shouldn't let these things go by without recognizing that you won't have heard this had it not been for Bob and for his orchestrating an understanding of how to wake people up by using various ideas and information brushed against each other. I don't want tonight to go by, since Bob started talking about himself, without saying that I've had an opportunity of working with him for over 5 years and have done on-the-ground research and traveled around the world in order to ascertain whether or not the perceptions which he said he had and the patterns which he perceived were accurate. And in all cases, after coming back with the research, Bob in all cases was batting 1,000. But certainly the Ciceronian ideal of eloquent wisdom has found cogent existence once again in our time after thousands of years, thanks to Bob Dobbs. And as an artist, he has fulfilled his culturally heroic function. Destiny may be there, but his culturally heroic function of purifying the dialect of the tribe, the Herculean labor of cleaning the Aegean stables of speech, thought and feeling was something he did regularly every time he was on the air. And his job was not to sign, but to read signatures. Existence, of course, must speak for itself. It is already richly and radiantly signed. But Bob was, fortunately we had Bob here, who was able to reveal, not to forge the signatures of existence, but to reveal them. And he put these for us all in order by discovering the orchestral analogies in things themselves. And the result for our listeners has been a hymn, a harmony, and joy as a pure ensemble ordered in the sharpest and most vivid circumstance of their interrelations. So I think that I just wanted to say that we're fortunate to have had Bob Dobbs, and we all owe him a debt of gratitude.
Are you reading that, or are you making up as you go along?
It's the sentimental part of the programming.
I never know what I'm going to say until after I've said it.
Who wrote the appreciation of Bob that was just referred to, that you read earlier in the show?
I wrote that.
Oh. Oh, well, I guess you had to get somebody close to the source to write that. Oh, okay.
No, I know what I'm about, so I could just describe myself. It wasn't hard to write what I just wrote.
Okay, it sounded like it had with a ghostwriter.
We need some more eulogizing. Anyone else like to care to eulogize?
Oh, I'm running out of eulogies, but it's good to talk to you again, Bob and Tom. And who else is in there? Haley's in there, and Wayne's in there. And
this isn't a eulogy, Haley. This is a birth announcement.
Yeah, it's Lockdown Bob Rule. So, we got any more callers? Yeah. Okay, thanks, Ed.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for getting Tom worked up.
Get me worked up.
The old hard-on from 69 is back.
Are subgenii more nocturnal than other people, or is that just...
No, there's no way you can categorize subgeniuses. Yeah. I know some geniuses they get up at 6 o'clock every morning.
Yeah, I have to take a long nap to be nocturnal these days. Good night.
When do you have to take a long nap?
I have to take a long nap early in the evening so I can be nocturnal.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to my nap. Good night.
Okay. Thank you, Ed.
Thanks, Ed.
Okay, caller. Yeah.
Scott again.
Okay.
Because my eulogy, I fumbled my eulogy a little bit. But I had to say that tonight is certainly on the scale of Furry Lent.
Really?
Like, you know, all of Furry Lent compacted into tonight's show.
Well, thank
that
you.
Sort of epic scale. It washes over you and you're left on an unknown shore and you start to navigate your way again.
Well, that, I mean, the excess reading helped do
yeah.
that, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm glad you listened and appreciate it. On August 8th, I think we'll present a special broadcast, which I don't think anybody could predict.
Yeah.
And hope you're around August 8th to come in for the climax.
No question. Hey, take me on a little tour of the UN now.
Okay.
Do they really have that odd little temple that the Christian Book Club or whatever talks about?
You mean in the bottom of
underground
St. John?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. That's there.
Strange, eh? And then you look at the five permanent members of the UN Security Council?
Yeah.
Are they all nuclear powers?
No.
No, what we got, China?
There are no nuclear powers.
There are no nuclear there are no nuclear powers to wipe us off the face of the earth, you know that.
Yeah.
From Dr. Beter.
Yeah.
Praise his memory.
So they're not nuclear powers.
Yeah, but I mean...
They're bankrupt.
This is the pretense they're setting up for wiping out Saddam Hussein, right?
Yeah. No, the five permanent members of the United Nations get there by being incredibly bankrupt. Because money is a poor man's credit card, and the oligarchs use mixed corporate media. They don't deal with money or any anthropomorphic threat zones. They just use the whole cultural interaction as propaganda. And that's what they're sitting on.
Yeah. And I got to refer back to the conspiracy 1400 to 2020 in delivering my eulogy, because I have to admit, I think I learned as much from the nature of your questions and observing the way your mind worked as I did from the straight-up information from the Exodus.
Well, that's an accurate perception of my intention.
Yeah,
the questions there had to be evoked. That's what Tom Richards is referring to. Percept's a question. So if you present certain modes of information juxtaposed against each other, it evokes certain effectual questions. And when you become familiar with those questions, the answers are relevant and also transient.
So it's been great, that one last time, Bob.
Well, we still got one more show.
Yeah, we still got one more show, but, I mean, there's so much pathos in that undertone music.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to clear the stage again.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Scott. What time is it? Oh, five after? Well, I guess that's it. Haley, did you want to say anything? I can't hear you. I don't know why there's a... It's not on.
Oh, well, okay. Now it's on.
Yeah.
There we go.
Okay, what were you saying?
This is a sad finale to what's been a glorious... How many years? Seven or...
4 years.
Four years
is Bob Dobbs.
Yeah, there's somebody else that has to be thanked. But I think this is too early. There's another show
coming. Yeah, this is just the beginning.
What's all this sappy stuff anyway? I thought we were supposed to be sort of, crusty contemporaries here.
Next show, I'm reporting from San Francisco, continuing my on-the-ground research. So the shows are over, but Bob and I are busy on the job.
Yeah, there's new work to be done. So let's do the Tai Chi hymn. Wayne, I want to thank you again for excellent work, and it was an important week for Mike and Wayne. They both had their 30th birthday this week, and it's incredible that two people born within 24 hours of each other end up working with Bob here in the Tiscarnas State. I'm sure that must mean something, and I just found out that a really close friend of mine from way back, his birthday is July 21st, that's Marshall McLuhan's birthday, so maybe that's why I walked around with him as a kid. He had the same birthday as McLuhan, and we didn't know it. So I was talking to Marshall back then.
So we got one more show, and we were actually practicing a bit of media ecology last week, apparently. nobody showed up to do the show, and it was just
I noticed
2 hours of silence.
I noticed something about the silence, yeah. I think I caught
just
the
getting
end of
people
it.
Ready.
All right, so what else? Media ecology, August 8th, begins after that show, August 8th.
August 8th, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yep. So
if it gets too sappy now, I mean, we won't have anywhere to go for the next program. So I think we have to ease up on that.
It'll be 3 weeks, Haley. It'll be a whole different world in 3 weeks. It's just this day evoked this mood. It won't continue tomorrow.
That's right.
It's a whole different mood in three weeks. Who knows what
happens? Could be president.
That's right.
Prime Minister.
And Tom Rich could be
Premier.
Premier. All right, and Wayne, you could be pregnant. Right. So let's we got the tape set up. Okay, this is a nice bit of music. I hope the next programmer can handle it. Goes for about 3 minutes and ends abruptly. So we're talking 3 minutes of Tai Chi hymn. Thanks a lot, Wayne. Hope you go home and meditate on the Exodus reading since you were a physicist.
Praise Bob.
Thank you.